Ohio has passed a bill that allows for a billion-dollar bailout of the aging, decrepit nuclear reactors run by First Energy. That's Davis Bessie and Perry Nuclear. Most of the state opposes this bailout, and citizens groups around the state collected signatures to get a referendum on the ballot to reverse this bad bill. At least, that's what they tried to do. But then you hear about a program, a planned system of interference with the signature gathering process. And when you ask a genuine nuclear expert how bad it is on a scale of 1 to 10, and he says,
"That's about 100. This is fascism, pure and simple. The nuclear industry hired thugs to physically assault people who are gathering signatures or who were approaching to sign to support a legitimate referendum. I mean, this is an all-out attack on democracy itself."
Well, when you hear how desperate the nuclear industry is to not only seize profits but hold on to them to the detriment of legal constitutional process, and it's all for the nuclear industry to get more money, 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 you realize how desperate some people in corporations are to make certain that we stay forever in that ever hotter seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a look at the bailout of First Energy's nuclear reactors and the increasing harassment and interference with people in Ohio who were gathering signatures to put a referendum on the ballot that can reverse this billion-dollar bailout. It's like something out of the latter stages of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, when the kids are trying with their little mimeographed newsletter to get word out about Jeff Smith, and they meet with vicious thugs hired by a media mogul with political aspirations. Anti-bailout Davids versus First Energy's nuclear Goliaths? That's what we've got going here. We'll hear from two veteran activists familiar with this situation. Pat Morita is chair of the Ohio Sierra Club's Nuclear Free Campaign and a member of the core team of the National Sierra Club's Nuclear Free Campaign. And the esteemed journalist, activist, and so much more, Harvey Wasserman, who never met a word he cared to mince, lets us know exactly how bad the situation really is. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than was available on Black Friday or Cyber Monday or any of those other nicknamed days. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, December 3, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off here in the U.S., where on November 20th, the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendments Act was advanced by unanimous voice vote to the House of Representatives by the Energy and Commerce Committee. If passed, the bill would move forward with safety licensing, that's an oxymoron, for a permanent nuclear waste repository at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, while providing the U.S. Department of Energy with the authority to proceed with a program for consolidated interim storage while the Yucca Mountain project progresses. What you need to understand is that Yucca Mountain is a convenient lie, because if we think there's going to be a permanent repository, then it's legal to create interim depositories for the waste. New Mexico doesn't want this. The governor doesn't want it. The state lands commission doesn't want it. The tribal people do not want it. The vast majority of people of the state do not want to become a nuclear dumping ground. And this is being foisted on them under the illusion that it's going to be interim, quote unquote, when this is just a setup to dump the waste in New Mexico and then abandon Yucca afterwards. We will have much more about this on an upcoming special about nuclear waste on Nuclear Hot Seat. And in other tribal news, the Northern Cheyenne have joined in a blanket rejection of Black Hills uranium mining permits. If permitted, the Dewey Burdock uranium mine and mill in the southern Black Hills would become the first radioactive in situ mining in South Dakota. This style of mining leaches uranium ore from the ground by injecting chemicals into the underground water table to dissolve the deposits. According to one commentator to the EPA, the water will inevitably become contaminated, as indeed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission finding states, quote, the restoration of an ISL, in situ leach mined aquifer, to pre-mining water quality is an impossibility. Over to Japan, where Tokyo Electric Power Company reports that rainwater contaminated by radioactivity in an exhaust stack may be leaking into the ground. The 120-meter-tall chimney was heavily contaminated with radioactive material in the 2011 nuclear triple meltdown, and rainwater coming out of the duct contains high levels of radioactive substances. But TEPCO says that it has not confirmed any impact on the environment so far. They didn't say whether they were actually looking for it, and if they did find it, they didn't say that they would actually report it. But TEPCO says it will consider measures to prevent leakage. Isn't that special? Consider. Japan's Tohoku Electric Power said that it has received regulatory approval to restart a reactor at its Onagawa nuclear power plant. Onagawa was closest among Japan's nuclear stations to the epicenter of the magnitude 9 earthquake on March 11, 2011. The station was swamped by the resulting tsunami, but survived with its cooling system intact, saving its reactors from the threat of meltdowns similar to those that occurred at TEPCO's Fukushima nuclear power plant to the south. More on Pope Francis and his recent trip to Japan, where he went all nuclear. At public appearances in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, he called for an end to the nuclear arms race, denouncing any use of atomic weapons as, quote, a crime not only against the dignity of human beings, but against any possible future for our common home. Of nuclear power, he said, I wouldn't use nuclear energy until it is totally safe to use, emphasizing that a nuclear accident could always happen, that's a direct quote, and would necessarily be, again I quote, big. And during an in-flight press conference aboard the plane bringing him back to Rome, the Pope dropped a bombshell when he said, the use of nuclear weapons is immoral, which is why it must be added to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, not only their use, but also possessing them, because an accident or the madness of some government leader, one person's madness can destroy humanity. And the Catechism sums up in book form the beliefs of the Catholic faithful. We will link to a transcript of that press conference, and I, for one, can't wait until that no nukes message starts being preached from every Catholic pulpit in the world. In Canada, the premiers of Ontario, New Brunswick, and Saskatchewan, known colloquially and collectively as the Three Stooges, have entered into an agreement to develop small modular nuclear reactors. This is an unproven technology. There is no one design that is agreed upon. And it is widely seen as a means of siphoning off taxpayer dollars for the next 10 years, as opposed to doing anything to directly address the climate. The age of nuclear waste is well upon us. In South Africa, spent fuel storage at South Africa's Coburg nuclear plant will reach full capacity by April, and they have no other place to put it. In Germany, that country is closing all of its nuclear power plants, but now it has to find a place to bury the deadly waste for a million years. We'll link to that article. And now there's a new report that decries unresolved and incalculable risks of radioactive waste. It's the World Nuclear Waste Report. It was issued on November 11th in Berlin, and we will link to an article about that on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 441. We will also link to an absolutely delicious article exposing the misinformation of Michael Schellenberger and his pro-nuclear lobbying group, Environmental Progress. Schellenberger, who I referred to as the Shillberger because of the way he shills for nuclear, writes regularly as quote-unquote an environmentalist for Forbes magazine, among others. It's a great read. And now...
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
The European Union has forged a trade deal with Japan that removes controls over radioactivity levels in foods produced in Japan following the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster. As a result, even Britain will soon be selling goods from the disaster-hit area, including breakfast cereals, fish, crustaceans, meat, green tea, and baby food. Even worse, current plans do not allow for the contaminated products to be labeled, meaning consumers will not be aware the food contains traces of radioactive substances. So let's take a look at that word, traces. When radiation exposure, quote-unquote, safe levels are calculated, what's being measured is external exposure, and the model used is a 150 to 170 pound man, approximately 25 to 30 years old, a military model, if you will. But external radiation exposure is far less dangerous than internal exposure, which is what you get when you eat food or drink water or breathe air that has radionuclides in it. After Fukushima, Japan raised the allowable levels of radiation in its food from 20 becquerels per kilogram. It's a unit of measurement. Just pay attention to the numbers. 20 becquerels of radiation per kilogram. But after Fukushima, they raised it to 100 becquerels per kilogram. However, the European Union sets their limit at 1,000 becquerels per kilogram, and the United States, in its wisdom, at 1,200. So food that is too radioactive to be legally sold in Japan is perfectly legal to export to the United States, the European Union, Britain. Internal contamination from radiation can lead to a wide range of illnesses later in life, including cancers, autoimmune diseases, heart disease. And yet, at the moment, 100 becquerels of radioactivity per kilogram of food is permissible even for cereals eaten by children. And for baby foods, 50 becquerels is allowed. How much should be allowed? Zero. None. Nil. But Japan keeps pushing the trade agreements to make it seem as though everything is A-OK in Fukushima, and that there is no reason for concern as to the internal radiation exposure of babies, children, even adults. And that's why whoever was behind this particularly ridiculous, if not heinous, bit of permission to this nuclear perpetrator, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat Num Nuts of the Week.
Well, it's official. It's December, and the holiday season is upon us. Time for me to share with you how grateful I am for all of your support of Nuclear Hot Seat throughout the year. It's simple. Without your assistance, it's impossible to keep the show running, and I could not keep it going. Good news, the website revamp is proceeding. All things internet take longer than we expect, but still, it's going. With the goal being easier searchability, a great new look, and the capacity to keep uploading an endless number of new episodes, which will keep going until the nuclear problem is solved or we reach the half-life of plutonium, whichever comes first. The problem is that it's going to be a major expense, well over and above our regular operating costs, and we still have to raise the money to cover it. Some of you have already provided financial support to go towards this new website, for which I am deeply grateful, because that's what's allowing me to start the process. And we'll need help from a lot more of you to get this beautiful, more functional new website up and running. So if you are grateful for the kind of verifiable nuclear news you get here every week, please consider showing it with a donation. Any amount helps, be it a one-time donation to honor the holidays, a monthly sustaining donation, whatever. It all helps to keep honest, verifiable nuclear information flowing out to you. We make it easy to help. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. Know that whatever you can afford, whatever you can do to assist us, you are helping to combat the nuclear menace in all of its forms with solid, footnoted, reliably sourced information. That makes me deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care about these issues and the show. Here are this week's featured interviews. Ohio is a hot mess on the front lines of nuclear industry manipulation, and today we've got two veteran activists to paint the full, ugly picture. First, we hear from Pat Morita. She has been working as a volunteer in the anti-nuclear movement since 1981, which is when her son gave her a copy of the book by Carl Sagan, Cosmos, and she read about nuclear dangers. All through the 1980s, she worked with the Ohio Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. Then, from the 1990s to the present, she has volunteered with the Sierra Club, where she is currently a member of the Ohio Sierra Club's executive chapter and chairs their Nuclear Free Committee, and is also a member of the core team of the National Sierra Club's Nuclear Free Campaign. And as if that's not enough, Pat is also part of an international group of Americans and Canadians raising issues of nuclear threats to the Great Lakes. She and I spoke on Sunday, December 1st, 2019. Pat Morita, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. Thank you for having me.
Pat, we need some context for understanding what's going on in Ohio. So give us some background specifically on Ohio House Bill 6 and what it does.
House Bill 6 bails out FirstEnergy's aging and embrittled nuclear plants, which are Davis-Besse and Perry on Lake Erie, Beaver Valley in Pennsylvania, and they're only 4 miles from the Ohio border. And since it's illegal for Ohio to directly subsidize any particular energy source, Ohio Republicans, when they crafted House Bill 6, called it the Ohio Clean Air Program.
Untruth in labeling.
And cleverly, the word nuclear is not even in the bill. It, of course, is written in a way that only gives a bailout to FirstEnergy and their two nukes and two coal plants. As the bill reads, from 2021 all the way through 2027, all of the Ohio ratepayers will pay a monthly surcharge on our electric bills. And that'll be from 85 cents for residential customers up to $2,400 for big industrial customers.
And that's a per month charge.
Per month, yes. And the total has been estimated to bring in about $1.1 billion for FirstEnergy. So that with that in mind, with that much at stake, so that's enough money that they're willing to spend a whole lot of money to get that big purse. And actually right now, FirstEnergy customers in Northern Ohio, they currently pay by far the highest electric bills in the state, because of the two nuclear plants up there. House Bill 6 also bails out two FirstEnergy coal plants, and these coal plants are old, hyper-polluting, and they're on the Ohio River, Southern Ohio. Well, one of them is actually in Indiana. Actually, the whole bailout is a gift to FirstEnergy with no strings attached, because there's no requirement for upgrading the facilities.
With this bill putting together a bailout for the nuclear plants and the coal burning plants as well, how does it impact renewable energy standards and energy efficiency standards in the state?
It guts renewable energy standards. In 2008, Ohio passed a bill, an excellent bill actually, requiring utilities to get 12.5% of their power from renewables by 2027. But House Bill 6 reduces the target to 8.5%. It exempts large industrial customers. and it kills the standard after 2026. So this destroys any incentive for new renewable energy development in Ohio.
And what does it do to energy efficiency standards?
It completely guts them because Ohio's efficiency law required utilities to reduce customer energy use by 22% over a 20-year period using energy efficiency programs. And it's been successful because energy mandates have so far cost Ohioans $1.5 billion and are scheduled to save $8.7 billion over their lifetime. But House Bill 6 allows utilities to end efficiency programs at 17%. Most of them have already reached that. So essentially, it guts efficiency standards.
How in the world did a bill as bad and as against the public interest as House Bill 6 in Ohio get passed?
In April, the first bill was proposed in the House, and it had a lot to do with the money coming in to the legislators from First Energy. The bill was continually changing, so a number of hearings were required. I testified myself 4 times. It passed the House at the end of May. Then the legislature was scheduled to recess at the end of June, and the Senate had still not passed the bill. So the legislature extended their session, and members who were on vacation were called back to Columbus to vote. The bill passed the Senate by 1 vote on July 17th, and then the House concurred on July 23rd. So the bill could not have passed without the support of some Democrats, because several free market Republicans voted against the bill. But then our governor, Mike DeWine, who's a Republican, he was in favor of the bill, said all along he was in favor of it, and he signed it. Now, Ohio is, as voters go, pretty close to evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. But yet, the House has 60 of 99 members are Republicans, and 24 out of 33 members of the Senate are Republican, and that's due to egregious gerrymandering.
How is this bill being perceived by the voters of Ohio, and how has the media been covering it?
Completely unlike other industry-backed proposals, House Bill 6, it was almost universally badmouthed by Ohio's media. They did not like it at all. It was opposed by ratepayer groups, it was opposed by business groups, free market conservatives, including some Republicans in the legislature, opposed it, environmental groups opposed it. And at the hearings that we went to, the only proponents were pretty much those who had vested interest, which was First Energy and its hired PR firm. The PR firm hired by First Energy actually wrote statements for some of the witnesses.
Well, isn't that special? So the bill has been presented and passed and forced through with trickery, with smoke and mirrors, with long-standing pressure points being pushed within who actually gets a chance to vote on it, meaning through the gerrymandering and all this other manipulation. So First Energy seems to be operating in the very definition of bad faith, both with the public and, it seems, also with its workers. Give us a little bit of background on the company so we can understand exactly the nature of who and what you are up against.
So you mentioned the workers because, you know, the workers up there are, they're between a rock and a hard place. And so the union can't blame them necessarily for trying to support their jobs. And the communities also can't blame them because they're going to lose a lot of tax revenue when these, if these companies go out of business, these large nuclear companies. So what we say is that let's assist the towns and the workers. And workers can be rehired to do decommissioning, and towns can be assisted. We don't need to assist dirty nuclear power. As a background on First Energy, I actually talk about First Energy and First Energy Solutions interchangeably, but they are really separate entities. First Energy Solutions is a limited liability corporation, an LLC, which means exactly what it states. Corporations put their liabilities into the LLC and protect the parent company when the limited liability corporation goes belly up. First Energy Solutions is a new entity that now owns the decrepit nuclear and coal plants, but it did not exist as a standalone entity until First Energy decided to put its generating entities into bankruptcy court earlier this year. So before that, we did not have First Energy LLC. Now we have First Energy Solutions LLC.
So it's a corporate shell game where even if anything bad takes down First Energy Solutions, the parent company remains intact and cannot be gotten to. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And actually, it was bad business decisions that caused First Energy the financial woes, because if you read their yearly reports, Davis Bessie and Perry actually show a small profit. On March 28th, the end of March, First Energy Solutions, this newly created limited liability corporation, asked the Department of Energy to issue an emergency order to provide cost recovery to the coal and nuclear plants in the PJM, which is the Regional Transmission Interconnection. But the Department of Energy did not have the authority to intervene, so they got denied there. And they went to PJM, but PJM, the Regional Transmission Authority, had already denied First Energy Solutions a bailout. They've been asking for bailouts for a long time.
It seems outrageous that a judge in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court approved First Energy Solutions could spend its assets, the assets left after declaring for bankruptcy, on lobbying for House Bill 6. How is that even possible?
According to some people that I talked to who know about a bit about bankruptcy, they never heard of such a thing. But actually, in truth, that is exactly what happened. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court, Judge Alan Kostchick, approved them to spend lobbying money on House Bill 6, so they had nothing to lose. It was money they weren't going to have anyway. Not only that, but First Energy Solutions asked for a $100 million bonus plan for employees, but that bonus plan, they wanted to exclude union workers. So they wanted to give themselves, the big shots, a bonus of $100 million out of the bankruptcy assets. And the judge went ahead and approved a $126 million bonus plan, which was bigger than the one they asked for, but that included bonuses for unionized employees.
But that was done in bad faith on the part of First Energy, because what happened the same day that House Bill 6 passed?
They don't waste any time. They don't want to put up a pretense. On that same day, they told the bankruptcy court that it wanted to dishonor the union contracts for the plants, including worker pensions. And in order to get the unions to support House Bill 6, they had promised, First Energy had promised, that the contracts would be honored. So there's a lot of duplicity happening there.
This is absolutely infuriating. And of course, there's more infuriating information to come. What was the impact of all of this legal haggling and manipulation on renewables within the state of Ohio?
The bill does have $20 million that would be divided among six existing solar projects in the rural areas down in southern Ohio. But actually, this is meaningless because First Energy is still required under House Bill 6 to develop more renewables. So that's just part of the gift to First Energy.
And what did it do to wind?
First Energy was actually behind a wind setback that was passed in 2014. It was tacked on at the last minute to the budget bill. And there was only 10 minutes allowed for discussion. Now, this bill requires 1,300-foot setback from any property line.
In other words, the windmill, or the whatever we're calling the turbines now, have to be set back from any property line by at least 1,300 feet. So yeah. It's almost impossible for anyone to be built that has enough clearance around it for it to be legal.
Yeah, well, it's impossible to build a wind farm in Ohio. Newspapers reported a $4.2 billion loss in economic development in Ohio and a potential loss of 13,000 jobs.
As a result of this totally intended to block and successfully blocking the development of wind energy and wind power in the state.
Yes, and that's been that way since 2014.
With all of these shenanigans from First Energy and First Energy Solutions, what are some of their codependent agencies doing? In other words, what kinds of concessions and waivers has First Energy asked for and been granted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Specifically, we're talking about safety and maintenance here.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I have a very long list of these. They're somewhat different between different reactors, but for almost all the reactors, there's longer periods between inspections. Emergency plans have not been updated, are not required to be updated. Flooding and other recommendations from Fukushima lessons learned have not needed to be implemented. Intervals between containment leakage tests were extended. Exemption from records retention requirements.
In other words, they don't have to keep their records of that they've been taking through all of this?
That's pretty scary. Yeah.
Wow.
And there could be liability there. They've been given exemption from the definition of physical barrier. That was Davis Bessie, at least, that got that dispensation.
And what does that mean?
The NRC said that barbed wire is good enough of a physical barrier to keep, I guess, potential terrorists off the property at Davis Bessie.
I think Sister Megan Rice proved that false about 5 years ago when she and two other senior citizens got into the Tennessee Valley Authority facility and did their peaceful plowshares protest there. It needs more than barbed wire to keep out potential terrorists or just mischief makers. Keep going, because the absurdity of this is not entertaining, but it's like, how much worse could it get? Wait, there's more.
Missile generation by tornado has been deferred. Now, what is the problem of missile generation by tornado? Well, a tornado hit Davis Bessie in 1998, and it was the worst direct hit by a tornado that ever happened to a U.S. nuclear plant. So what happened was it picked up machinery and debris and threw it at the plant. But now they have a deferral. They don't have to clean up the mess that's around the plant and clean up the things that might be hurled against the plant. Other things that are happening, which the NRC has approved, is the use of high burn-up fuel. I know you've had Donna Gilmore and others on that have talked about this, but this allows them to burn the fuel longer and hotter with less refueling. And high burn-up waste is hotter. When its usefulness is over, it's hotter. It takes longer to cool. They aren't even sure what all is going to be inside of some of these new high burn-up fuels. And it's harder to contain. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has neglected to update U.S. nuclear regulations in order to meet the International Atomic Energy Agency recommendations. So U.S. nuclear reactors don't have to follow the IAEA recommendations. Even after getting all these waivers, the NRC continues to give First Energy's reactors good safety marks.
It's stupefying. It's like, what and how were you allowed to get away with this? Did nobody ever slap your hand when you went to the cookie jar? I mean, come on.
And another issue is the Environmental Law and Policy Center, they have a lawsuit against First Energy because First Energy is attempting to avoid its obligation to fully fund the decommissioning funds for its nuclear reactors. So this is an important lawsuit to follow, and it's still in court.
You know, this is stupefying information as to how much this one corporation is getting away with to the detriment of people and the environment. It must be costing a tremendous amount of money. What do we know about the kind of financial clout First Energy is putting behind all of this?
First Energy is one of the biggest money players in Ohio politics. And papers report that First Energy spent as much as $50 million, or maybe even more, on lobbying firms and coalitions like Ohio Clean Energy Jobs Alliance, get that name, which supported the bailout. It's also reported about four secretive companies that put $2.6 million into Ohio Republican primaries, which was back in May of 2018. They put that much money, and they're looking for candidates that would support the First Energy bailout. It was amazing. We did not find out this until recently, but way back then, a year and a half ago, First Energy was figuring on doing this and supporting in the primaries, in the Republican primaries, supporting their folks that would vote their way. Papers have reported that the secretive group Generation Now, it spent $9 million of dark money on ads promoting House Bill 6. We were blanketed with deceiving ads. We got mailers. It was all over TV and radio, newspapers, digital media ads, phone calls. And they were threatening like these dire consequences if House Bill 6 did not pass.
So it sounds like there was a full slate of deceptive practices that Ohioans were hit with. Was this even before the referendum?
Yeah, this was just promoting the passage of the bill. Wait till we see what happens when this referendum gets started.
Well, let's go there now. What is the referendum? What would it do? And then let's get into the next wave of misbehavior and worse on the part of those who are pushing for the bailout.
So in Ohio, we citizens can have a referendum that would overturn a bill that the legislature has just passed. So a group called Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts was hired to conduct a referendum that would overturn House Bill 6. And the signatures of registered voters for any referendum are needed to be collected from all around the state. This effort, however, was paid for largely by oil and gas interests, interestingly enough, who were strongly opposed to the bill. But they had the money. Citizens groups really didn't have the resources for a big endeavor like that. But unfortunately, the gas company weren't familiar with these kind of citizen actions that are usually undertaken by citizens. Neither the firm that was hired to collect signatures nor the fossil fuel industry itself was familiar with the citizen appeal process. So the anti-bailout firm, they first wrote ballot language that was deemed inaccurate in 21 ways by Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who is a Republican. Now, I read the 21 inaccuracies, and they were all problematic. So it was not a political ploy by the Secretary of State. But the disapproval task took 20 days out of the 90-day referendum period. And so they had to go back and rewrite ballot language. That took 18 more days. So 38 days was eaten into the 90 days, allowing for signature gathering, which left only 52 days. 265,000 valid signatures were needed, which means that many more actually need to be collected, many more signatures than that.
What kind of actions have been taking place against the referendum and the signature collecting process?
Dark money put millions into defeating the referendum and opposing the signature gathering. I'd never heard of this, but firms were hired to harass and intimidate signature gatherers, and they were asking people not to sign. A couple of signature gatherers that happened to belong to the Sierra Club reported that they were followed, where a signature gatherer in Columbus was being harassed. And that person attempted to take a photo of the offender. And so the harassing woman actually slapped the phone from the signature gatherer's hand, actually physically, you know, sort of attacked the guy, and it broke the phone. So he has a lawsuit out now against this action.
I understand that the in-person harassment was not the end of the kinds of pushback and dirty tricks that have been attempting to take this referendum out before it could actually be considered. What are some of the other things that have been tried?
They blanketed Ohio with what we call fake petitions. Newspapers are calling them fake petitions. So these are non-binding petitions that stated support for a nuclear power bailout. They caused great confusion. It said that they collected 400,000 signatures, but it was a lot easier to collect non-binding signatures where anybody could sign. And apparently a lot of money was spent on these petitions. And one of the petitions said, stop foreign ownership of our electric grid. That was a petition you could sign. And it was paid for by a group called Ohioans for Energy Security. And that was an insane statement, had no basis in reality. Worst of all, the state was blanketed again with these lying ads, outlandish. Radio, TV, social media, all the same thing as before. And they were saying foreign entities have invaded our energy grid. And this is right off the postcard. It says they want to kill our jobs and raise our rates. Decline to sign. There were also xenophobic kind of ads, really, threatening a Chinese conspiracy to take over the energy grid. One flyer I have says, if you see a circulator, report them to this hotline.
The circulator being the person who's actually asking for signatures on the legitimate petitions.
That's right. And then the group points to Chinese bank loans to some natural gas burning power plants. That's what the Chinese conspiracy is. A Chinese bank has loaned money to natural gas plants. But in actuality, First Energy also has loans from that same Chinese bank. You know, there seems to be a position of authority that's writing these things and saying these things, and there people are looking to authority.
Have the courts been any help in stopping these deceptive practices?
A group calling themselves Ohioans for Energy Security filed a lawsuit before the Ohio Supreme Court, and that was seeking to block the referendum. And it argued that House Bill 6, fee on electricity ratepayers, constitutes a tax and thus is not subject to a referendum. What they seem to have forgotten that when House Bill 6 was first introduced, the promoters assured the public that it was not a tax. However, just last week, the outcome is that the court decided not to hear the case.
Where is the media in all this? Is any publication or broadcast outlet chronicling the attempts to derail the actions and block the bailout?
Yes, that's happening, and it's been good. I mean, there's been a lot of good reporting about the deceptions here. However, those are on the mainstream media, more or less, and they're on websites and things that people read, whereas these ads, you know, are constantly blasting out on TV, radio, and everywhere, which are much more likely to be seen, you know, the ads opposing it. So a lot of times, a lot of things that go on that are wrong, there's good publicity about it, but it just doesn't get into the hands of the majority of people.
Given all of this fighting back and forth and this domination because of the finances behind it by First Energy and their minions to guarantee in their minds that this bailout goes through, that the referendum does not get on, that there's no recourse, that they get their money and it leads to whatever it leads to, let the pieces fall where they may. Where does everything stand now?
Ohioans Against Corporation Bailouts failed to get enough signatures to overturn House Bill 6. However, it's not completely over, as that same group, Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts, has asked the courts to rule that Ohio law allowing ballot language to cut into signature gathering time. They're saying that that's illegal, and that they should be given 38 more days to collect the signatures, the 90 days that they're supposed to have. So it seems fair, since 90 days, first of all, is not a lot of time, and then cutting into it.
By more than one third.
Yes. So cutting into it does seem like a ploy to stop citizen initiatives and referenda. That pretty clear to all of us, giving only 90 days and then cutting into it and allowing the Secretary of State to take a whole lot of time to make a decision on the ballot language, and all that cuts into time for collecting signatures for a referendum.
So there's still possibility. Is there any way of finding out whether those additional 38 days will be allowed?
Now they have taken it to the Ohio Supreme Court, which is the right court. The court is not required to hear the case, so we don't know the outcome. We're all keeping our fingers crossed that they will say that, yes, they have 38 more days, because that's really our last chance to prevent this bailout from happening. And in the meantime, House Bill 6 went into effect on October 21st, although rates will not increase until 2021.
Conveniently after the elections. Pat Morita, you and others in Ohio are taking every step possible and are really on the last options now. You've obviously been working long and hard on these issues against a Goliath. In the original version, David won, and we can only hope that that carries over for you and the others who are fighting to get this referendum on the ballot and reverse House Bill 6 and the bailout of First Energy Solutions. For now, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It was my pleasure.
Pat Morita is chair of the Ohio Sierra Club Nuclear Free Committee and so much more. To get a more pointed perspective on what's happening in Ohio, I managed to track down the insanely busy Harvey Wasserman. For those of you not already familiar with Harvey, he is a journalist, author, democracy activist, and advocate for renewable energy. He has been a strategist and organizer in the anti-nuclear movement in the United States for more than 30 years. Media-wise, he's been a featured speaker on Today, Nightline, National Public Radio, CNN, Lou Dobbs Tonight, and other major media outlets. We spoke on Monday, December 2, 2019.
Harvey Wasserman, thanks for joining us on short notice here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure.
You have been in the anti-nuclear movement for decades, and you've seen a lot. Given what is going on in Ohio with the intimidation of petition gatherers and disinformation that's been thrown towards the public regarding the referendum, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the worst, how bad is this in terms of intimidation of an anti-nuclear perspective?
That's about 100. This is fascism, pure and simple. The nuclear industry hired thugs to physically assault people who are gathering signatures or who were approaching to sign to support a legitimate referendum. I mean, this is an all-out attack on democracy itself. We've seen a lot of things, but we have not, prior to this, seen hired stormtroopers physically assaulting people who are trying to put a referendum on the ballot. I mean, it's astounding.
What are the chances, do you think, of this referendum still moving forward, given the number of roadblocks that we've already heard about that have taken place?
It's going to be very difficult. First of all, it's hung up in the court, which is what the industry wants. They have used the Ohio Secretary of State and Attorney General to delay the signature gathering. You're supposed to have 90 days, and they used up 38 of those days just with the state offices deciding whether or not they can go on the ballot. And then when they did put people out there, finally, when we got the petition approved for circulation, as I say, we were assaulted, physically assaulted by thugs. And so the signature gathering came up short. And I don't know if there's going to be more time to get more signatures. And then what will happen when people go out to collect the signatures, if they're going to be assaulted again, which is highly likely, by these Gestapo stormtroopers?
What, if any, legal or police recourse might there be to these actions?
Well, the police don't care. I mean, the bottom line is that the Ohio government has been purchased by the nuclear industry. The Ohio Supreme Court, 7 justices, 3 of them had to recuse themselves because they took money from First Energy. So, you got half the Ohio Supreme Court has been already bought by the industry, and who knows what else who else they bought. They've certainly bought the legislature to get this bailout through, even though the huge majority of Ohioans opposed this bailout. First Energy bought most of the Republicans and some of the Democrats and got it through.
What is likely to happen on this point forward? Do you think we have any chance of getting that referendum on the ballot?
There is some chance. You know, we had a federal judge who remanded the case to the Ohio Supreme Court. He asked the Supreme Court to answer a few questions about the nature of the referendum. And then the Ohio Secretary of State asked the Supreme Court not to answer the federal judge.
Is that even legal?
Who knows? We're talking about, you know, the age of Trump here, so anything's legal, as long as a corporation does it.
What, if anything, can those of us who live outside of Ohio do to support the work of those who are still fighting to get the referendum on the ballot?
Well, you could probably send financial support to the Ohio Sierra Club and maybe send the emails to that we can pass on to the federal judge. But, you know, we have the support, by and large, of the Ohio media. Very corporate media in Ohio, very right-wing, but some of the biggest papers in the state have been appalled by this horrible fascism, and we'll just see. We got to wait now to see what the courts are going to do, but we are hamstrung at this point in time. I mean, it's a shocking situation. The First Energy, which is in bankruptcy, running two plants. One is more than 40 years old. One is more than 30 years old.
You're talking about Perry and Davis-Besse,
Davis-Besse,
correct?
Davis-Besse, in addition to two 50-year-old coal-fired plants, one of which is in Indiana. I mean, they're really just showing that they can do anything they want. However insane it is, they think they can get away with it. And at this point in time, we're hamstrung. We'll have to see. I mean, there will be court challenges to the bailout, but there's no doubt that if a referendum got on the ballot, we would win. And that's what they're fighting. So this is not only about nuclear power. It's about the legitimacy of the referendum process.
Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is as bad as it gets. Ohio, once again, is as bad as it gets. We saw an election stolen in Ohio in 2004. We've seen ridiculous gerrymandering. We see two nuclear plants on the lake, one of which was the first American reactor to be harmed by an earthquake. The other, Davis-Besse, which is just infamous for its and complete lack of safety and maintenance. And at this point in time, the nuclear utility, which is in bankruptcy, for God's sakes, has stolen $1 billion from the people of Ohio. And at this point in time, we're being denied recourse entirely with a destruction of the referendum process by physical violence. I don't know how it gets worse than that.
Harvey Wasserman, who is not only a journalist, author, and democracy activist, he has also been a strategist and organizer in the anti-nuclear movement in the United States for more than 30 years. On our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 441, we will have links up to both Harvey's website and also the Ohio Sierra Club Nuclear Free Committee. Activist shout out! Films! 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 There are three big documentaries on core nuclear issues on the horizon, and they're all going for completion and presentation in 2020. First is Heidi Huttner's Accidents Can Happen, The Women of 3 Mile Island. Next is Lisa Wolf's film, Rocky Flats. And Lois Lipman, whose Downwinders follows those people downwind of the Trinity test in Alamogordo, New Mexico, who have never been acknowledged or helped. Each of these films at this point is shot and are heading into the editing process. We will keep you up to date on the progress of each one. Here's this week's final thought, and it's written by Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, the author of Women Who Run With the Wolves. She wrote, "My friends, do not lose heart. We were made for these times. In any dark time, there is a tendency to veer towards fainting over how much is wrong or unmended in the world. Do not focus on that. There is a tendency, too, to fall into being weakened by dwelling on what is outside your reach, by what cannot yet be. Do not focus there. That is spending the wind without raising the sails. We are needed. That is all we can know. And though we meet resistance, we more so will meet great souls who will hail us, love us, and guide us. And we will know them when they appear. Ours is not the task of fixing the entire world all at once, but of stretching out to mend the part of the world that is within our reach. Any small, calm thing that one soul can do to help another soul, to assist some portion of this poor, suffering world, will help immensely. It is not given to us to know which acts or by whom will cause the critical mass to tip towards an enduring good. What is needed for dramatic change is an accumulation of acts, adding, adding to, adding more, continuing. We know that it does not take everyone on earth to bring justice and peace, but only a small determined group who will not give up during the first, second, or hundredth gale. Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes. And to all the great souls listening to this show, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, intercontinentalcry.org, currentargus.com, nhk.or.jp, asahi.com, kyotonews.net, catholicoutlook.org, channelnewsasia.com, CNN, independent.co.uk, globalnews.ca, express.co.uk, telegraph.co.uk, and wiseinternational.org. If you don't want to miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, that's really easy to do. We're now available on all your favorite podcast platforms, so you can subscribe there. You can also go to nuclearhotseat.com and scroll down for the yellow opt-in box. You put in your first name, you put in your email address, one email a week with the show and a brief description of what's in it. We will not bug you further. Now, if you see something happening nuclear-wise in your part of the world, don't assume I know about it. Please reach out. That includes story leads, hot tips, and suggestions of people to interview. You can do so by sending an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please don't use Facebook. It gets lost in the shuffle and it changes too often. Send it info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, please take a moment, happy holidays, to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We are really grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that nuclear waste is dangerous forever, and that's why we have to stop making any more of it right now. There you go. That was just your nuclear wake-up call. So please, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.